Okay, this is Amos chapter 3. We read about the punishment, the coming punishments in the first two chapters of the Amos were mostly the coming punishments of Israel and Judah and also the nations round about Israel and Judah, which would be punished. But the children of Israel, as we are going to find out here in Amos chapter 3, are being punished in a different manner. They are being punished for the purpose of correction. So here we shall also see that there is hope of reconciliation and recovery in that punishment. And that's about all I'm going to say right now.
Microphone muted.
Martin.
Amos 3. Hear this word that Yahweh hath spoken against you, O children of Israel. Against the whole family which I brought up from the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. Can two walk together except they be agreed? Will a lion roar in the forest when he hath no prey? Will a young lion cry out of his den if he have taken nothing? Can a bird fall in the air upon the earth where no gin is for him? Shall one take up a snare from the earth and have taken nothing at all? Shall a trumpet be blown in the city and the people not be afraid? Shall there be evil in the city and the Lord hath not done it? Surely Yahweh God will do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his servants, prophets. The lion hath roared, who will not fear? Yahweh God hath spoken, who can but prophesy? Publish in the palaces of Ashdod, and in the palaces in the land of Egypt, and say, assemble yourselves upon the mountains of Samaria, and behold the great tumult in the midst thereof, and the oppressed in the midst thereof. For they know not to do right, saith Yahweh, who store up violence and robbery in their palaces. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, an adversary there shall be even round about the land, and he shall bring down thy strength from thee, and thy palaces shall be spoiled. Thus saith Yahweh, as the shepherd taketh out of the mouth of the lion two legs, or a piece of an ear, so shall the children of Israel be taken out that dwell in Samaria, in the corner of a bed, and in Damascus, in the couch. Hear ye, and testify in the house of Jacob, saith Yahweh God, the God of hosts, that in the day that I shall visit the transgressions of Israel upon him, I will also visit the altars of Bethel, and the horns of the altar shall be cut off and fall to the ground. And I will smite the winter house with the summer house, and the houses of ivory shall perish, and the great houses shall have an end, saith Yahweh. End of Amos 3.
Well, this is one passage that we quote probably most often from Amos, at least, in the opening two verses. You only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. And the children of Israel were all taken into Assyrian captivity, or some of them were taken in later into Babylonian captivity. and their period of punishment began at that time, that period of punishment was prophesied in the book of Leviticus that it would last for seven times. And it's evident in the book of Daniel, where that period of punishment is actually described in the series of four empires that would rule over the children of Israel, and then the little horn that would arise out of the last of those empires to rule over the children of Israel. And we're told in the Revelation and in Daniel in corresponding prophecies that each of those periods of time would be 1260 years. And by that, we can understand that a time or seven times in prophecy is seven 360-year periods of a total of 2,520 years that the children of Israel were told that they would undergo this period of punishment. Now we're no longer ruled over by any of those entities that were prophesied in Daniel chapter 7, chapter 2, Revelation chapter 13. However, we're in a time of Jacob's trouble, which is prophesied in Jeremiah. And that's what I certainly believe, because we're told that Esau would become the head and Jacob would become the tail. And we can identify Esau as these Edomite Jews and Jacob as the nations of Christendom, the white European nations of Christendom is all that's left of Jacob. So that is that this one passage in Amos is basically describing the entire future of the children of Israel until they're reconciled in Christ, that they would be punished until the second coming or the return of Christ to become king. So I believe this, that these verses that say, will a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Yahweh is roaring, as he described himself. And I believe that's actually earlier in Amos, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, it's in Amos chapter 1. Yahweh will roar from Zion. And here we read, will a lion roar in the forest unless he has prey? He's telling the children of Israel that they're going into captivity, is basically what he's saying to them. Can a bird fall in a snare upon the earth where no jinn is for him? That language is sort of difficult. That word snare is a bird trap, and that word jinn is bait, right? The bird's not going to enter the trap unless there's bait there to attract the bird to the trap. So all of these are analogies that the children of Israel are going to be taken and snared go into captivity, be taken by their hunters. The lion roared, and that's Yahweh, again, Amos chapter 1, where he said that he would roar from Zion. Who will not fear? He's telling all of Israel that they ought to fear. Ashdod is a reference to the Philistines, Egypt. He's calling the enemies of Israel to assemble themselves in Samaria. The surrounding nations were subject to Assyria, and they took part in the destruction of Israel and later of Judah as subject armies, because they had to give tribute armies to the empire in order for the empire to accomplish this. That's how the empires worked. So an adversary there shall be round about the land, and he shall bring down thy strength from thee, and thy palaces shall be soiled. And that's basically prophesying the end of ancient Israel. Hear ye, testify in the house of Jacob, that in the day I shall visit the transgressions of Israel upon him, I will also visit the altars of Bethel and the horns of the altar. They were the altars to the golden calves that were at Bethel and at Dan. And here only Bethel is mentioned. but I'm sure that the altars of Dan were also taken down at around the same time. The winter house and the summer house, I actually had to look up my commentary to remember how I interpreted that back in 2013. The words winter and summer in Hebrew are words which describe different harvest times. The phrases winter house and summer house appear only here in the Bible. However, where we read winter in the King James and in Brenton's English, the Greek of the Septuagint has a word, peripateros, which means flying round about. Or, according to Liddell and Scott, it was also used as an architectural term describing a certain type of temple. Both references may be appropriate here. Bethel was in the southern part of the territory of the sons of Joseph, near the border of Benjamin. Dan was to the north, far above Galilee. It was several dozen miles north of Galilee. Therefore, the terms winter house and summer house may be allegorical references to the northward and southward towns of Dan and Bethel, which are the locations of the golden calves of Jeroboam 1. It's connected to that verse that is before it. The houses of Ivory shall perish, and the great houses shall have an end. In other words, the centers of idolatry in Israel would be destroyed along with the captivity of Israel. I don't know if anybody has anything to add, any questions.
Bill, so that period of time, the 2,520 years, that's the tribulation that the Judeo-Christian churches are waiting on, and that's over with, and we're now in the time of Jacob's trouble, correct?
Yes, sir. When Esau would rule over Jacob. Yes, sir.
Okay.
And that started, I believe, at the liberation of the Jews, the emancipation of the Jews in the early 1800s. And it lasted up through the 1850s. It took about 50 years for the Jews to achieve emancipation in all of the nations of Europe. The emancipation meant that Jews were recognized as equal citizens in every nation that they were. So they became citizens. They could again hold public office. They could participate in politics. And things like that equally with Christians, where for 1,000 years before that, they were precluded from those things. They could not do those things. Actually, it was more like 1,200 years in most places.
And it took a period of about 70 to 100 years in order to get Satan in the pit. Am I correct in saying?
Yes, probably a little longer than that. From the time of the acceptance, the tolerance of Christianity, to the declaration that Rome was a Christian empire, to the putting away of Satan in the pit, that happened mostly from the time of Justinian through the time of Theodosius I, Theodosius II, that they were all emperors of the Byzantine Empire, that had passed edicts against the Jews that precluded them from holding public office, from owning Christian slaves, and even more strict laws than that, that basically most Jews left the empire and they went into Khazaria and became the Khazar Jews, or what's called the Ashkenazi Jews today, which only means German Jew. That's all it means. And they went into the Arabian desert, and they were behind the founding of Islam. And they did those things in order to get back at the Byzantine Empire. They wanted to destroy it.
So after he got at the time that we could finally say that, or say that Satan's finally locked away, that would have been from about the year 800 to about 1805 when Napoleon emancipated him, right?
Yeah, but it was probably a little sooner than 800 for the most part. It was probably accomplished by the end of the 600s. But it was a process going in and a process coming out, right? It wasn't a clear-cut 1,000 years. It was actually a little more than 1,000 years. But it wasn't clear-cut,
yeah,
because Jews had slowly gained influence in Europe through the Kabbalah and alchemy and the science academies that were founded in the 18th century that Jews were behind, and Freemasonry and things like that. They used all of that to achieve their emancipation. Once they achieved their emancipation, all of a sudden we had democracy in Europe. How the fuck did that happen? all the seats of the kings were being dismantled through war and political uprisings and revolutions. And basically the feudal system and the old European nobility fell from power.
And so to bring on the French Revolution, we're seeing the tools that they use through this freedom, equality, that's the tools that they use to bring on that revolution, correct?
Yes, and the Masonic lodges and manipulation and control of the food supply. Inciting the people against the churches, against the nobility.
So, Bill, would it be a good statement to say that all of these other religions actually came out of the Catholic Church? Would that be a good statement or not?
What do you mean, all of these other religions?
The denominations, did they come out of the Catholic Church? Because the Catholic Church was formed to control the people, and the churches today are doing nothing really but controlling the people through the same mechanism.
Well, right, and that started, and the Jews had a hand in that also. They had a hand in the Reformation also. I discussed that at length in Martin Luther and Life and Death and the Jews in Medieval Europe podcast series that I did 7, 8, 9 years ago. That the that I wish I had time to continue. That the a lot of the Christian denominations started to form actually as early as the 1400s, and I think it was in the 1400s you had Jan Hus, that the Czech reformer who split, he managed to successfully split, his followers did, that the Czech church away from the Roman Catholic Church, and it stayed like that for several decades, I think, so maybe longer. So you had reformers pushing the church in the 13 and 1400s, and the church was becoming more and more corrupt, and it wouldn't reform. So, I mean, the Reformation was really the final split of anybody who was successful, because a lot of others tried and failed, right? Anybody who was successfully split from the Roman Catholic Church, and that's when all these modern denominations started to spring up. But some of them started earlier than that. I mean, Martin Luther, he, the 95 Theses was supposedly published, I think, in 1517 or 1518. He died in 1563. By that time, the Protestant churches in Northern Germany were already, in Germany and other places, were already broken away from the Roman Catholic Church. But after that would come the 30 Years' War. During the 30 Years' War, there was a counter-reformation led by Jesuits within the Catholic Church, and a lot of countries that had gone Protestant were actually brought back to the church. The power of the church was over by the time of Napoleon, though. Napoleon actually arrested the Pope. He died in prison.
User, I think it was 2 years. From your channel.
But he also emancipated the Jew everywhere he went. And he tried to conquer Europe. So he did a couple of good things, and he did mostly bad things, because he was probably an agent for Jewry all along. I can't prove that, but even though he did some good things, he had his own currency, he wouldn't borrow from the Jewish banks. He did a lot of bad things.
Actually, there's a death mask of Napoleon, and if you get a good side profile, he's got a super hook in that nose.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I don't know that. I mean, I only vaguely remember the way he's painted by medieval painters. Maybe you want to consider them Renaissance painters. I don't think it's kind of like post-Renaissance. But I never really paid attention to what he looked like. I guess he was short. And I don't even think that guarantees he's a Jew, so. In most of these, he has a pretty straight nose in most of these images that I'm finding on Google. But that's no guaranteed indicator of his race. If you look at, I think noses are often formed in the minds of the artist and don't represent reality. Noses in art. And you can see all the different nose shapes right in this artwork of Napoleon. I mean, there's many different nose shapes, so I don't trust that either. I don't trust any of the art ever.
Well, you'd probably need a couple of witnesses with a hook nose, such as he loans money for usury and he screws around. So if you can add a few things up and make him look like a damn parakeet, you probably got you a Jew, you know?
Yeah. If an aquiline nose or what we call hook nose, and there's different people have different opinions of each nose shape, if that alone marks somebody as a Jew, why would Christ say know them by their fruits? He'd just say know them by their noses. I mean, Jews have overbearingly large hooked noses. And when I see one of those, I'm thinking, well, this guy's definitely a Jew. But I don't think we could always go by the shape of somebody's nose, Martin. I just don't think so. And a lot of these noses, I could show you noses on statues in Independence Hall that I took pictures of, and almost every one of the founders looked like he had a hooked nose. Were they all Jews? Most of them were good white Christian men from Christian European backgrounds, demonstrable Christian European backgrounds. So is it the artist that did that? I don't know. I have those images posted at Christigenia somewhere, I think.
Microphone activated.
Well, you said it best one time. It's the whole picture. When you look at a Jew, it's the whole package that sometimes tells you that they're a Jew. And it's not necessarily one in particular, one thing, one physical trait.
Yeah, you know what's more alarming to me sometimes is sloped foreheads and ears are more alarming to me than the shape of somebody's nose, I swear. You see the sloped foreheads, the big orbits, and they have these ears that are slanted and attached to the bottom of their jaws instead of like where most white people's ears are. And that to me is more alarming than the nose.
Yeah, to me, the pointy chin, the really pointy chin is a trait that they often have.
Sloped forehead.
Yeah, the sloped forehead and the big orbits.
You know what? They also have pointy tongues, a lot of them. It's not just Gene Simmons, you know? They really do, but you don't see it often enough.
I don't want to look at their tongue. Well, yeah, and noses in art are definitely no indication, because I believe that the nose, I mean, I've seen three, four, five different nose shapes on the same historic figure in three, four, five different paintings. I've seen it all the time. Seven,
it says, Yahweh does nothing. Is that the attitude of the people?
Where's that, Joe?
User disconnected.
Joe's dragging us back to Amos. I'm sorry. What verse is that, Joe?
I think his mic's not working.
It's 7.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, Joe, I think that is the attitude of the people, because in verse 6, shall a trumpet be blown in the city and people not be afraid? Shall there be evil in a city and Yahweh has not done it? In other words, if evil comes upon a city, it's a punishment from God. Surely Yahweh God will do nothing, but he reveals his secret unto his servants, the prophets.
Oh, it could
be. The
lion
Lord who will not fear. And in other words, those verses are saying, yes, Yahweh has done it.
Yeah, so he doesn't do anything unless his prophets say it. That wouldn't be true, though, because he might do stuff that he's... No, he does what his prophets say. Yeah, I get it now. So it's what his prophets say and announce, that's what Yahweh's going to do.
Yes. As far as Israel is concerned.
How did I get this working?
What do you have? You reinstalled your operating system?
Yeah, I had to again. Yeah, I had to, and had to get it all working again.
Okay.
Amos 4.
Why not? I can't find the pictures of those statues I was talking about. Damn it.
Amos 4. Hear this word, ye kine of Bashan, that are in the mountain of Samaria. Oppress the poor, which crush the needy, which say to their masters, bring, let us drink. Yahweh God hath sworn by his holiness that, lo, the days shall come upon you that he will take you away with hooks and your posterity with fishhooks. And ye shall go out breaches every cow at that which is before her, and ye shall cast them into the palace, saith Yahweh. Come to Bethel and transgress at Gilgal, multiply transgressions, and bring your sacrifices every morning and your tithes after the 3 years. And offer a sacrifice, thanksgiving, with leaven, and proclaim and publish the free offerings. For this liketh you, O ye children of Israel, saith Yahweh God. And I also have given you cleanness of teeth in all your cities, and want of bread in all your places. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. And also I have withholden the rain from you, when there were yet 3 months to the harvest, and I caused it to rain upon one city, and caused it not to rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered. So two or three cities wandered unto one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. I have smitten you with blasting and mildew, when your gardens and your vineyards and your fig trees and your olive trees increased, palmer worm devoured them. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. I have sent among you pestilence after the manner of Egypt. Your young men have I slain the sword, and have taken away your horses, and I have made the stink of your camp come up unto the unto your nostrils. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. I have overthrown some of you, as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and ye were as a firebrand plucked out of the burning. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. Therefore, thus will I do unto thee, O Israel, and because I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. For lo, he that formeth the mountains, and createth the wind, and declareth unto man what is his thought, that maketh the morning darkness, and treadeth upon the high places the earth. Yahweh, God of hosts, is his name. End of Amos 4.
Go ahead, Joe.
When Christ was on earth, he declared to men what their thoughts were. So this is another proof that Christ is Yahweh. That's all.
Yes. Yes, there's probably a lot more verses or passages like that in the Old Testament that we haven't yet found or pointed out. I'm sure there are that we haven't yet realized. But Yahweh states repeatedly in the words of the prophets that it's he who reads the hearts and the minds of men. That it's he who knows the thoughts of men and nobody else.
Jesus knew their thoughts and said to them, every kingdom divided against itself will be ruined.
Yes. Oh, yes. But that, yes, that proves that he is Yahweh. I would think. Because he very often revealed that he knew the thoughts of men before they had them. Even though he usually waited for men to express them.
Yeah, in 13 where it says, and declareth unto man what is his thought, that reminds me of what Paul said, to examine every one of our thoughts.
Right.
Because sometimes you do come to a conclusion about what you're really thinking, and it's not really you, I don't think, that's coming to the conclusion, but perhaps he's declaring it to us, you know?
The kine of Bashan is a reference describing the children of Israel.
It's feminine, too.
Hosea 4:16, for Israel slides as a backsliding heifer. Hosea chapter 10, and Ephraim is a heifer that is taught and loves to tread out the corn. So that sort of analogy appears often. Where it says that the enemy, that he will take you away with hooks and your posterity with fish hooks. So the Septuagint reads very differently. They shall take you away with weapons and fiery destroyers. shall cast those with you into boiling cauldrons. That's the Septuagint. I don't know why the difference is there. I haven't studied it lately anyway.
So when it talks about the kind of Bashan, could it also be talking about the golden calves, like in Amos 3?
Yeah, I made that observation in my 2013 commentary. They were worshiping calves, so they must be calves, right? You're made in the image of your God. That's why today most people look like pigs. I'm sorry. Talked about these 400-pound popcorn-eating football fans. I'm a few pounds overweight myself, but I don't watch football.
I don't have all my Bible tools at the moment, but this Amos 4:1, where it says, "Hear this word, ye kind of Bashan," that's feminine. And I believe from memory, the masters might be their husbands. So it's saying these women of Bashan, which oppress the poor, which crush the needy, which say to their husbands, "Bring and let us drink." I think that might be it.
Yeah, heifer actually is cow there. It is feminine. You're right, Joe. That's a good observation.
And are they saying to their husbands, bring us drink, I think. Masters, I'll have to check masters.
That's also what it says in the Septuagint. Bring and let us drink. But that may well be a reference that to the international trade that the children of Israel had already been criticized for earlier in Amos.
But that word for husbands is Adon, so it could also mean master.
Yes. It's translated masters in the King James Version, but a woman's husband should be her master. So the reference can go either way. It could work either way. Because they're female heifers, I would write master, not husbands. But we can see the analogy.
Yeah, it says which oppress the poor. It could be just an insult to men using the feminine to describe them.
Yes. Yes, that's what it seems to be. That's a good observation. And you shall go out at the breaches. That every cow at that which is before her, that those italics interpolations in the King James Version are often burdensome, cumbersome. The NAS has, you shall go out through breaches in the wall, each one straight before her, and you will be cast to Harmon, the name of a place, I gather, that I, where the Septuagint has on the mountain Roman or the house of Rimmon, seems to be a better translation than what Breton has, which was a place of idolatry, 2 Kings 5:18. Although Harmon, the Hebrew, is a Hebrew word which means castle or fortress, which is why it's palace here in the King James Version. I admitted there was difficulty translating the passage in my 2013 commentary. But it's stating that captivity is imminent for the children of Israel. However, it should be read after the manner of the Septuagint, the NAS, or the King James Version. Gilgal is also a place of idolatry. It just wasn't one of the places that Jeroboam I had appointed for the priests of the golden calves. There's another reference to Bethel here in verse 4. He's inviting them to transgress some more, apparently. Cleanness of teeth in verse 6 is really a famine. Cleanness of teeth and want of bread. Your teeth stay clean, you haven't eaten. He withheld the rain, caused a drought 3 months before the harvest. I caused it to rain upon one city and caused it not to rain upon another. I've smitten you with blasting mildew. Evidently, there must have been plagues and droughts in the years leading up to the time when they would be taken into captivity. So he's speaking about all the punishments that he punished them with. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Yahweh, at the end of verse 11.
And he says, he plucked us like a brand plucked out of a fire. Well, that's like us today. We're like in the flames of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yes, that we feels... are. Without a doubt. So the next chapter is basically the result of all of their sins, and that they're not heeding the times that they were punished. In chapter 5. It's not quite a full conclusion yet, though.
Chapter 5.
Well, where it says, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel, they're not really meeting Yahweh. They're really going to meet the punishment that he's going to send upon them. But in the Septuagint, it says, prepare to call on thy God. Because I guess when the enemies are at the gates, that's when they'll call on God. People don't call on God until they have calamity.
It's the only way they understand.
Chapter 5, Martin, this one's long. Let's split it in chunks, huh?
Amos 5. Hear ye this word, which I take up against you, even a lamentation, O house of Israel. The virgin of Israel is fallen. She shall no more rise. She is forsaken upon her land. There is none to raise her up. For thus saith Yahweh God, the city that went out by 1,000 shall leave 100, and that which went forth by 100 shall leave 10, the house of Israel. For thus saith Yahweh unto the house of Israel, seek ye me, and ye shall live, but seek not Bethel, nor enter into Gilgal, and pass not to Beersheba. For Gilgal shall surely go into captivity, and Bethel shall come to naught. Seek Yahweh, and ye shall live, lest he break out like fire in the house of Joseph, and devour it, and there be none to quench it in Bethel. Ye who turn judgment to wormwood and leave off righteousness in the earth, seek him that maketh the seven stars and Orion, and turneth the shadow of death into the morning, and maketh the day dark with night, that calleth for the waters of the sea, and poureth them out upon the face of the earth. Yahweh is his name, that strengtheneth the spoiled against the strong, so that the spoiled shall come against fortress. They hate him that rebuketh in the gate, and they abhor him that speaketh uprightly. For as much, therefore, as your treading is upon the poor, and ye take from him burdens of wheat, ye have built houses of hewn stone, but ye shall not dwell in them. Ye have planted pleasant vineyards, but ye shall not drink wine of them. For I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins. They afflict the just, they take a bribe, and they turn aside the poor in the gate, their right. Therefore the prudent shall keep silence in that time, for it is an evil time. Into verse 13.
In verse 3, it seems to be saying that 90% of the children of Israel will die or go into captivity, and that 100 will be left. That's what it seems to be saying. That there were people left behind, and we could see that in the historical books of the Old Testament, in 2 Chronicles chapter 34, in the reformation of Josiah, when he brought the nation back to Yahweh, and he invited everybody to a Passover feast, and he broke down all the groves and the images, and he burnt the bones of the priests, the pagan priests, upon the altars, and cleansed Judah and Jerusalem. And so did he in the cities of Manasseh and Ephraim and Simeon, and even unto Naphtali, with their mattocks, or I guess their villages round about. In the New Testament, there are many Samaritans that are Israelites that the apostles are bringing to Christ. And the Samaritan woman is one example, the woman at the well in John chapter 4. And Christ had stayed and preached to her and her kinsmen and neighbors for 2 days, I think, or at least until through the next day. Seek him that makes the seven stars in Orion. That seems to be parallel to the seven stars in the hand of Christ in Revelation chapter 1, if the constellation of Orion is said to form a cross. I never saw it. I can't tell a constellation in the night sky. I'm sorry. I'm a city boy all my life. Now that I live out in the woods and I can see all the stars, I can't tell which ones are which. The prudent shall keep silence in that time, for it is an evil time. And that's the way it is with any type of judgment. Is the people who are being judged often suffer from tyrannical government. And if you speak out, that you're probably going to be lynched or killed. Or the sinners will kill you. And we live basically in that sort of time today, where if you try to speak righteousness to the public, they want to kill you. You speak righteousness on the internet, you get everything canceled. You lose your accounts, you can't stay on social media. That's the way it is. If you like your job, you can't speak out publicly because you'll lose your job. Can't speak against sodomy, can't speak against race mixing. You lose your livelihood, you'll lose your house, whatever.
And that's what Christ was doing, and that's why they crucified him.
Yep, exactly.
We still sort of have a duty to speak, but the prudent shouldn't speak, it seems to say. Like the fact that we don't announce the sins to Israel, and I'm guilty too, because I know I'll be arrested. That's like a sin for us, so we deserve to suffer with the rest of our people, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, right. We have no choice. We've spoken out in public and in places that we frequent in public, and we always get thrown out. And we can never go back. We don't go back.
We all have blood on our hands, all of us.
Right.
What is that they say? Ignorance of the law is no excuse to deny the law.
Yeah, you're still going to be judged by God. If you say, I don't believe in God, that's not some sort of way to get around judgment.
Yeah, right. Well, in our early years, everybody here participated in the system. Before we found this. And now that we found this, we still can't do everything that we should be doing.
Are the stars the seven spirits of God, or are they this? In Revelation 1:20, it says the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches.
Right. I understand that, but I think they're representative, that these stars represent them, right?
Yeah.
Let's see. Orion looks, Orion, I should probably pronounce it. Let's see what it looks like.
That's how I say it.
Yeah, you have the belt of Orion, which is like, what, three stars?
I think it's the Big Dipper, the seven stars, and Orion.
And, yeah, he's holding the sword.
And that's where we get the swastika.
Oh, the Big Dipper.
Yeah, the four seasons, right?
There's a picture of Orion and in January, or an illustration of it, I should say.
Where it talks about the gate, what in mentions it frequently, that's just like a metaphor in like your dealings with the public, with the people that surround you.
Which verse is that, Martin?
Well, when it talks in this chapter and in the previous chapters, when it talks about you know, the comings and goings in the gate and things that happen at the gate.
Yeah, because that's in every town. That's where the business was conducted. That's where trials were conducted. And quite often, that's where the prophets stood and proclaimed their judgments, proclaimed the word of God. And the judgment of God on the people. It's all through Ezekiel. It's also in Isaiah. For the terrible one is brought to naught, and the scorner is consumed. All that watch for iniquity are cut off, that make a man an offender for a word, and lay a snare for him that reproves in the gate. Because that's where judgments were declared. And the prophets of God would reprove the people at the gate of the city, because that's where the market was, that's where the courts were. Athens and the Greek cities were the same way. They were laid out the same way. And that's where the business of the city was conducted. So when you wanted to address the people, you went to that gate near the market and you proclaimed your judgments.
It just makes sense, because if travelers are coming to your town to trade, you want to in the out the gate so that they can access your markets and that easily, and they don't get into the deeper areas of your city.
Hate the evil and love the good, and establish the judgment in the gate.
What would the gates of hell be then? I'm thinking now.
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think that the analogy or the allegory is the same there.
Yeah.
For I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins. They afflict the just, they take a bribe, and they turn aside the poor in the gate from their right. In other words, the poor have no recourse in the courts when they're oppressed by the rich. And in verse 11, for as much therefore as your treading is upon the poor. And not only here in Amos, but also in Hosea, the children of Israel are upbraided for that. They're criticized for that because they were oppressing the poor of their own people to enrich themselves. We do the same thing today through this system of capitalism and individualism, where the poor are kept poor. I'm not talking about the poor that are on meth or welfare or niggers.
This Babylonian system is like a market and justice system. It's connected in the same way.
Yes. Yep, justice goes to the highest bidder or to the rich.
I mean, like, it's a mercantile type system, a mercantile and justice system. That's what Babylon is. A mercantile, a bunch of merchants and their law, their injustice.
I just have trouble understanding what part people can't see in this. You walk through the store and these people look like they just fell off of a damn tree limb, you know?
Yeah, every time I go to the supermarket with Melissa, I notice that everybody's rude. They all walk around with hollow eyes, no expressions on their face. They don't talk to anybody. You smile at them, you get nothing back.
It's horrible. It is.
Even the customer service professionals aren't that great at doing their job, because they're supposed to be a customer service professional, and even they're rude and they're impatient.
Yep. I don't know if they all just want to go back to their cell phones. I don't know, man. Crazy. There's a Pearl Jam song we always joke about called Yellow Ledbetter, and Eddie Vedder's talking about his neighbors that are up on the porch and they don't wave. And all our neighbors here are like that. They're on the porch, but they don't wave. So we joke about that song about our neighborhood every time we hear it. Very few people are friendly anymore. Some of them wave, but not many. I don't know if they're just rude or if they just heard about me. I don't know.
Low trust society, Bill. It's sad. It's low trust. No one trusts anyone anymore.
I know. I noticed that for the first time when I was 17 years old, leaving a concert at Madison Square Garden. And I walked in the wrong direction to the train station because I didn't know and I had to find it. I saw this old woman, and it was a pretty crowded street. It wasn't an empty street. And I saw this older woman. I said, "Ma'am, do you have the time?" And she just said, "Oh," and she ran. She kind of ran away from me. And I'm like thinking to myself, "What the fuck?" Yeah. That was in 1978. A very low trust society. Even back then, it was getting bad. And that's because they moved all these niggers in. And all this crime started happening. So white people even lose trust for each other because people don't want to be racist. They might even be killed by white people.
Well, not only that, but I mean, the people that you might think are friggin' white are cryptos. And they end up, you know, backstabbing, right?
Or yeah, they're just... But yeah, I grew up, I mean, when I was a little boy in Jersey City in 1964, 65, I don't remember 63, right? I was only 2 years old for most of 63. But in 64, 65, 66, it was a very high trust society. And that all began to change with the nigger chimp outs in 67 and 68.
Especially when they emancipated the nigger.
Yeah, that there were two waves of riots. One in 67 across the country. And Jersey City had a big riot with niggers. And then King got killed in 68, and there was another wave of riots. Then it seems like the nigger population exploded. And the nigger neighborhood just like quadrupled in size over the next 10 years. And it became an extremely low trust society during that time.
So getting back to what Joe was saying about the gates, Babylon ruins began to be archaeologically investigated in early 20th century. Between 1902 and 1914, German archaeologists unearthed Ishtar Gate remains. Vast majority of the fragments found there were moved to Berlin, where it was rebuilt in the Pergamum Museum. So this Pergamum Museum, they actually, in Revelation, where it talks about, you know, how the throne of Satan was in Pergamum, and I guess there was a temple to Zeus that was in Pergamum. And they at that time, the German archaeologists took stone by stone that temple of Zeus, and they reconstructed it in Berlin, along with this Ishtar Gate. But yeah, that temple of Zeus, those people are they're white Northwestern Europeans, clearly.
Yeah, the point.
Yeah, and just the whole thing with the that they gate that they had.
The Germans and the British both did a lot of that in the archaeological period of the 19th and very early 20th centuries. They did a lot. They brought a lot of relics back and set them up in the British Museum or in Germany. In various places in Germany, they set up a lot of that stuff to put it on display. I don't think they were trying to worship it. They were just trying to preserve the history of it, which wasn't going to be preserved in the Muslim countries that they got most of it from. The Turks didn't care for it. The Syrians didn't care for it. It's not their heritage.
I think now that we're in, you know, a more understanding, progressive time, they should take it back.
Yeah.
They should take it back to Syria and put it there.
Yeah, let them have their idols back. There's actually a lot of them they want back. Egypt wants their stelae back. The Greeks want the Parian marbles back. There's a lot of stuff they want back.
Yeah, but they aren't the Egyptians and they aren't the real Greeks.
But the Africans don't want the niggers back.
Yeah, right. There was I saw something on social media that I didn't get a chance to look into, but the Swedish government was saying something like 90% of the refugees and refugees from African countries that have been admitted to Sweden have vacationed in those African countries that they fled from. Get the fuck out of here. How dumb could we be?
Did we finish Amos 5?
No.
No, not yet.
We should.
Okay, Amos 5, verse 14. Seek good and not evil, that ye may live. And so Yahweh, the God of hosts, shall be with you, as ye have spoken. Hate the evil and love the good, and establish judgment in the gate. It may be that Yahweh, God of hosts, will be gracious unto the remnant of Joseph. Therefore, Yahweh, the God of hosts, the Lord saith thus, wailing shall be in all streets, and they shall say in all the highways, alas, alas, and they shall call the husbandmen to mourning, and such as are the skillful of lamentation to wailing. And in all vineyards shall be wailing, for I will pass through thee, saith Yahweh. Woe unto that desire the day of Yahweh! To what end is it for you? The day of Yahweh is darkness and not light. As if a man did flee from a lion, and a bear met him, or went into the house and leaned his hand on the wall, and a serpent bit him. Shall not the day of Yahweh be darkness and not light? Even very dark, and no brightness in it. I despise your feast days. I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Though ye offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them, neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs, for I will not hear the melody of thy vials. But let judgment run down as waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream. Have ye offered unto me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? But ye have borne the tabernacle of your Moloch and Chion, your images, the star of your God, which ye made to yourselves. Therefore will I cause you to go into captivity beyond Damascus, saith Yahweh, whose name is the God of hosts.
Well, there's nothing new under the sun, just as today people celebrate Christmas in pretense and use it as a holiday to exalt themselves. It was the same thing back then. And the feast days became odious in the eyes of God because people didn't use them as a time of fellowship, communion, and repentance. Instead, they used them as a pretense to party and to exalt themselves. So it didn't matter if they celebrated them as not or not, Yahweh wouldn't accept them. He wouldn't accept their offerings any longer. They were guaranteed to go into punishment.
Why would God say, woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord? I mean, don't we desire that day, Bill?
Well, I remarked on this in my 2013 commentary. The day of the Lord, the day of Yahweh, in the Old Testament, Israel was going into captivity to be punished. So if you desired that day, well, you would see captivity and be punished. You weren't going to have any reward for that desire. You're going into captivity with the rest of the nation, or you're dying with them. As Yahweh said in Ezekiel, speaking of Jerusalem, that he would cut off both the righteous and the wicked. In what we wait for today is completely different. In this age, when Christ was asked about his return and the end of the age, the day of the Lord and the day of his vengeance and all that, from Luke chapter 21, he said, and then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to come to pass, look up and lift your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. Our attitude today should be totally opposite. In this ancient world, when the day of Yahweh's judgment came, Israel was going into punishment. And in this present world, when that judgment comes, Israel shall be regathered to Christ. They will be saved from this punishment. This is the beginning of 2,520 years of captivity. Now we're praying for the end of it, and the end of the time of Jacob's trouble. That don't mean it's going to be easy, but we should rejoice that it's here. Because we know, as Christians, we should know that there's a better world right around the corner.
Amen.
We always do the opposite. He tells us to weep when they enter and rejoice when they leave. We do the opposite.
I really believe what's pertinent to our time, and we discussed this a few months ago, is Ezekiel chapter 9. What were the people that were mourning the sins of Jerusalem? But we're actually rewarded for that. And it's those people that'll lift up their heads and rejoice that the present world is being judged. But when ancient Israel was being judged, it was for captivity. And that was the words of the prophets.
In verse 26, but ye have borne the tabernacle of your Moloch, and Kiyun your images, star of your God, which ye made to yourselves. So that word Kiyun, it means like a some sort of pillar. That symbolize apostate Israel.
Yeah, that word tabernacle is a sukkuf. I believe that's where the word Scythian comes from, right? Sukkuf is a tent. This Bible Works 10 is claiming it's also a Babylonian deity. I don't know about that. I mean, that sounds kind of strange and new to me. I want to look that up real quick. In the original Strong's Concordance, I never heard that before, Babylonian deity. I had to get my work light so I could see my book.
But it almost makes it sound like it's a verb, like it's something in action that's being done to the images.
Yeah, I mean, Sakuth and Strong's, it is just a tent, but he has an idolatrous tent. Well, that might be how it's used sometimes, but that's not the real meaning of the term. I want to look it up in Jesenius real quick to see if there's anything about this Babylonian deity. I don't believe that, right? I really don't. This new, the Strong's Concordance information in Bible Works is new. It's from a new updated Strong's. And I think that half the definitions are bullshit. Jesenius just has a booth or a tent, which the Israelites, turning aside to idolatry in the desert, constructed in honor of a certain idol. Well, so he compares the skene yera of the Carthaginians, but all the skene yera means is a priestly tent, the tent of the priest. That's not necessarily a certain idol, I don't think. So, yeah, I don't believe that Sukkoth is a Babylonian deity. I would have to see inscriptions on that.
Which
I haven't seen, but then again, I haven't read every inscription. I don't think anybody has.
Okay, and you're talking about the Kiyun or Chiyun or?
Well, the Chiyun and the Septuagint is Rephan, which is kind of weird.
Well, that's where they got Remphan.
Now, in the NAS and Amos, Moloch is just king, okay? It's just a king, and that's because the word Melech is a king, okay? It is in Hebrew. So where the King James has, you're born a tabernacle of your Moloch and Kion, your images, the NAS says you have carried along Sukkoth, your king, translating Melech as king and not translating Sukkoth as tabernacle, right? They just reversed it, and I think that I don't agree with that. And Kion, your images, the star of your gods, which you made for yourselves. That word gods, let me see what the form of that is, because, yeah, it's Elohim, it's plural, but the King James translated only as God. If it's not referring to Yahweh, it should be translated as gods, in my opinion. So, and that's because the word of God is not going to use a plural of majesty for false idol gods, right? It's not. So it should be translated as God. So I agree with the NAS there. The star of your gods, key on your images, the star of your gods, which ye made to yourselves, would be better. Key on is not key on in the Septuagint. It says the star of your God, singular, Rephan. And that is the reading that is found in the New Testament. I think that's in the Discourse of Stephen, if I'm not.
It's in Acts 7:43.
Yeah, that's the Discourse of Stephen. You took up the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of your god, Rempan. So in Acts chapter 7, verse 43, that just cited, that supports the Septuagint translation of, or the Septuagint version, I should say, of Amos chapter 5, verse 26. 100%. The tabernacle of Moloch, not the Sukkoth of your king, and the star of your god, Rephan in the Septuagint, but Rempan in Acts actually tells me that There was variant spellings of the name. That's no big deal. They're very close, Rathan and Renthan.
Yeah, the NLT has a crazy translation. It says Zakuth, your king god, and Kaywan, your star god, the images you made for yourselves.
Wow. And you've lifted up. The tabernacle of Malak, or your the tabernacle of your king. But Malak, I would translate that in the context of the Old Testament. And Keon, the images. The star of your gods, plural, who you made for yourself, yourselves, plural, who you made for yourselves. So, I mean, the King James translation is a fair rendering of the Hebrew here. I would not follow the NAS and say Zakuth your king rather than Tabernacle of Moloch.
What do you think the Tabernacle of Moloch would be, just in your opinion, Bill? Would it, like, would they carry around an idol and a tent or something?
Well,
it looked like a synagogue with a big Star of Rephaim, Star of David outside.
Yeah,
I should have tried to imagine it. Yeah,
that there are the children of Israel passing their sons and daughters through the fire to Moloch. I don't think there's enough information in the Old Testament about this Moloch idol to really understand everything that the worship of Moloch entailed.
Yeah.
I really don't. Moloch was actually, the children were passed through the fires to Moloch in the Old Testament, in the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom, which is called Gehenna. In the New Testament. Imagine that. From Gay Hinnom, land of Hinnom. This is the last of seven times that Moloch appears in the King James Old Testament. We can't know what the Star of Rampan is. I mean, it's kind of a... It may not entirely be inappropriate to imagine that it's a star. They now say that is the Star of David, but I wouldn't ascertain that. I wouldn't be certain about that.
But what we can know is that it was the cursed people among the children of Israel who promoted these things.
Yes.
Idolatry.
From your channel.
Yes. That they learned those things from the Canaanites. Yes. That's what they were warned that they would do, and they did it.
Yeah, it could very well be. Sorry.
Go ahead, David.
I was going to say it could very well be the five-pointed star or the inverted five-pointed star, the one that's associated these days with Baphomet. And it could be the six-pointed star that they use. We don't know if it's any of them, but it seems likely that's at least one of them.
Oh, I agree. We can't know really what star it is.
Can we make any connection that that it's associated with Saturn? Or with Saturn worship?
I think so, because definition of Q
user disconnected from your channel
is associated with Saturn, if you look it up.
Could you? I wrote a little about the Baphomet thing somewhere recently. Oh, in the forum, I think. Yeah, I included a photograph of a book from Manly P. Hall, David.
Yeah.
In the forum, talking about that Baphomet tattoo on that clown's neck, that clown in Ohio. And the Baphomet image actually came from a French occultist and Kabbalist, and I believe a Jew named Eliphas Levi. And that's who Manly P. Hall attributed it to. The Blavatsky got it from this Elias Levi.
Yeah. I think that it's possible that he resurrected it, though, from something in perhaps the Kabbalah or, you know. Like...
Well, in ancient Egypt, Mendez, which is a popular Spanish name, but I'm convinced it's 100% a Marano Jewish name. Mendez was the ancient goat god of the Egyptians.
Yeah, the sexually insatiable god.
I don't know if the Mendez of the Egyptians was necessarily associated with the satyr, which was sexually insatiable. I mean, probably, right? But I never really looked into the Egyptian pantheon, if you will.
Oh, Martin, just to let you know, though, the Kiyun, right? It, in Brown Driver Briggs, it says proper name of deity, Assyrian, a planet Saturn, Kaivanu, regarded as a god.
I would want to look into that, but I didn't look up Kiyun and Justinianus. Not that Justinianus is always right. I found him wrong a few times in my Genesis commentaries.
So it cannot be established, the connection between the Tetragrammaton and the star of Kiyun.
No, I don't think you mean the Tetragrammaton. That's the name of Yahweh.
Or the name of the 12-pointed star.
12-pointed?
Or the six.
I don't think we could ever know for certain. It seems very likely. When you research it, you know, and they keep bringing these. As soon as they took over, like we were talking about earlier, when they were emancipated, that's when these all these stars started appearing in society on flags and products and that India shipping company, which was the biggest trading company in the world in the 1700s. And before that, it wasn't really used in Christian society. I stars were usually in portraits, paintings. They looked like crosses. You know, if you look at medieval times, It's just, it's something that since the age of liberalism has become ubiquitous in society, is these stars, you know, and you get a gold star for something good and so on, and red star, the communist symbol, and the list goes on and on. It seems to me that they're using old tricks that worked long ago again. And it's the chief.
There were stars on a lot of the European nobility's shields and things like that, but you're right, they weren't very popular on flags that I've seen. But they are on coats of armor. I don't remember them on any flags from medieval times, to be wrong.
I don't think it was used in popular vernacular as something positive. Like now everybody's a star in something, right? I don't think that there's any evidence that that was used, you know, pre-age of liberalism, like a, you know, rock star, movie star, etc. He's a star in this field and that field. So it's just something that they, and then Ashtaroth is basically a star too. I mean, or whatever you want to call her, Ashira.
What the hell?
You're still recording, David.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we can probably end recording. I'm thinking. My suggestions.